In 2013, Jesse's was one of 8,257 heroin-related deaths in the nation, by far the majority of them young men, an increase of a staggering 39% over the previous year. Roughly three-quarters of the dead had started down the same painkiller path that led Jesse to his death, the same path as Spencer Mumpower, Scott Roth, and Colton Banks, with a single prescription pill. A month after Jesse's death, the FDA approved a new high-potency, long-acting version of hydrocodone, Zohydro-ER, even after its own expert panel voted 11-2 against it, noting that the drug, which lacked an abuse deterrent, could lead to the same level of addiction and abuse as OxyContin had in its original form. The FDA concluded that the benefits of this product outweigh the risks. It would be four more years before the FDA would ask a pharmaceutical company to withdraw an opioid pain medication because of its potential for abuse, Opana ER, and not until 2017. And by then, the annual death toll for drug overdose had climbed to 64,000. Critics pointed out the inherent conflicts of a regulatory agency that both approves drugs and is then supposed to function as a watchdog over those drugs. The Zohydro approval was the OxyContin story all over again, said Dr. Andrew Kolodny, a doctor who lobbies for stronger painkiller restrictions. He said, the most damaging thing Purdue did, it wasn't the misbranding of OxyContin they got in trouble for, it was that they made the medical community feel more comfortable with opioids as a class of drugs. But had the FDA been doing its job properly with regards to opioids, we never would have had this epidemic. 2 weeks before Jesse's death, the FDA finally notified Barbara Van Rooyen via letter that a portion of her petition had been approved, specifically her call to withdraw its approval of the original OxyContin. The point was by then moot, of course. Purdue had already voluntarily withdrawn it 3 years after the reformulation came to market. She told me, I think my petition did ultimately help push the reformulation, but so many more people died while we were waiting for it. Van Rooyen said. Months later, after reading a New Yorker piece on the Sackler brothers, it dawned on her that the reformulation had almost certainly been prompted by the fact that Purdue was losing its patent on the original formulation, not because they believed the reformulated version was safer, nor because of my petition, Van Rooyen said. Still, the letter from the FDA disgusted and angered her. It made her mourn all over again for Patrick and the thousands of newly extinguished lives. In the same letter, the FDA denied her secondary request, which was to have the drug limited to severe acute or terminal pain and not prescribed for chronic use unless all other treatments had first been explored, guidelines most other countries in the world have adopted. Americans, representing 4.4% of the world's population, consume roughly 30% of its opioids. Patrick had been dead now for 9 years. It would be three more years before another federal agency would put his mother's suggestions into practice. Part 3. A Broken System. Chapter 9. Whack-a-Mole. By 2014, the suburban heroin-dealing scene had become entrenched in Roanoke's McMansion subdivisions and poor neighborhoods alike. But the largest dealers weren't twice-convicted felons like Ronnie Jones, with elaborate dope-cutting schemes, multiple cars, and hired mules. They were local users, many of them female, dispatched to buy the heroin from a bulk dealer out of state in exchange for a cut. And they were as elusive as hell to catch. Among Roanoke's first long-haul drug runners was a pretty brunette in her mid-20s whose name reflected her Hawaiian heritage, Ashlyn Kekalani Kessler. What distinguished Ashlyn as one of the region's top mules, according to the prosecutor who sent her to prison, wasn't just the volume of drugs she was transporting. It was also her body's astonishing ability to metabolize the drug without overdosing. Generally speaking, she told me, there are people who overdose all the time. Then there are people like me who never overdose. At the peak of her addiction, Ashlyn was using 50 to 60 bags a day. Her prosecutor said She had a remarkable liver. She was an unlikely addict, a young mom and paralegal with a criminal justice degree from Jerry Falwell's Liberty University. But her descent into drugs followed a familiar storyline. After the birth of her son in 2008, she was prescribed Lortab for mastitis, an infection not uncommon among breastfeeding mothers. She had lingering lower back pain, too. The baby's head had been resting on her spine throughout her last trimester. When the Lortab ran out, her obstetrician wrote her another script for oxycodone. Within 6 weeks of giving birth, Ashlyn said she was hooked. When her doctor left town after a few months and his replacement refused her refill requests, she bought black market OxyContin through a friend of a friend. She occasionally stole Lortab from her disabled octogenarian grandfather. She switched to Roxycodone in 2010 when OxyContin became abuse resistant, then to heroin when the black market Roxys became more expensive and harder to get. It's unreal how many people followed that same pattern. Oxys, Roxys, heroin, she told me. If you ask me, OxyContin is the sole reason for all this heroin abuse. If I had the choice between heroin and Oxys, I would choose Oxys. With pills, you always knew what you were getting. By the time her son learned to talk, Ashlyn was doing heroin and or heroin business with most of the Hidden Valley users. She had grown up in the North Roanoke County suburbs, but she had made lots of friends from Hidden Valley and Cave Spring. She said, places like Hidden Valley are where you can get some of the best heroin because those are the kids with parents that have money. From the Kentucky Federal Women's Prison, where she was serving a 7.5-year sentence for distributing between 13,000 and 23,000 bags of heroin, Ashlyn charted out via email the trajectory of heroin's suburban sprawl, with intersecting spheres of users she knew who were now dead or doing time. She pointed out news articles I'd missed about people she'd once used drugs with, including a young mother named April who'd recently overdosed in the parking lot of a Roanoke Dollar General store with her infant found crying in the car seat. She knew Spencer Mumpower and Colton Banks. At the height of her addiction, she'd wept through Scott Roth's funeral mass. She mapped out her spiral from user to dealer, from patient to criminal. 2 years into her addiction, she was fired from her job for too often being late or absent. Her coworkers had no idea she'd been shooting up in a stall of the law firm restroom where they worked. She had to have surgery once after a heroin needle became stuck in her arm, but told colleagues some crazy lie that I'd cut it on a fence, she said. After her dismissal from the firm, Ashlyn stole from her family to buy drugs, credit cards, checks, even heirloom jewelry from her Hawaiian-born grandmother, who is now, at age 80, raising her elementary school-age son. A relative visiting from Hawaii had predicted when she was a little girl that Ashlyn is going to break your heart, her grandmother Lee Miller told me. And sure enough, Ashlyn did. We enabled her, her grandmother conceded. Her grandparents paid for rehabs she typically left after only a few days. They sometimes gave her money to buy Suboxone on the black market because she'd get sick and have to turn to heroin if she didn't have it, she said. It was the car her grandparents bought, a 2013 Nissan Sentra, that led to Ashlyn's undoing and eventually, once she was forced behind bars to get clean, her saving grace. A dealer approached Ashlyn about driving him back and forth to New Jersey for 3 bundles or 30 bags of heroin. He had a Newark Connect, he called it, a relative with a source willing to sell to them in bulk. When they progressed to bricks or 50-bag allotments, they bought them for $100 each, then sold them back in Roanoke for 6 or 7 times that, she said, and made the 14-hour round-trip trek 3, sometimes 4 times a week. Her dealer typically sent his girlfriend along on these runs to keep an eye on Ashlyn, who was known to inject the heroin, swiping bags from their mutual stash, at rest stops en route to Roanoke. I now know that he enlisted me because I am a well-spoken, young, white girl that drives a nice car. Therefore, it didn't look to police like we were there for what we were really there for, she wrote. More important, her craving for the drug was so insatiable. Her skinny, desperate look practically screamed, white, female, addict, that no Newark dealer would mistake her for an undercover cop. When Ashlyn first landed in downtown Newark, heroin was so easy to get that the moment she left her car, a man approached her wanting to know, "Hey, baby girl, what you looking for?" By 2014, when DEA agents and federal prosecutors caught up with her, the government's case laid itself out in the 15,000 text messages recovered from her cell phone. Enough evidence to map out a pyramid of addiction from her New Jersey source to dozens of Cave Spring and Hidden Valley kids. The exchanges were marked by logistics, deals, and despair. "Can you meet me at Sheets on Peters Creek Road?" "What you got? Can you do two?" "Yeah." "You got 10 more? Can I owe you?" Ashlyn was almost home when Virginia State Police pulled her over on I-81 just north of Roanoke, 10 minutes from the end of another Roanoke to Newark round trip. Unbeknownst to her, Drug Task Force officers were following her movements with the help of a GPS tracker they'd hidden on the undercarriage of her car. She'd been on the radar 6 or 7 days, ever since a former classmate overdosed on the heroin Ashlyn sold him. He lived, selling her out to an undercover cop in exchange for avoiding jail time. Now, a week later, DEA agents were searching the trunk of her Nissan, beginning with her purple paisley Vera Bradley purse. They found the 722 bags of heroin, not so carefully hidden, inside the monogram bag. She and a friend had already blown through half a brick. Now they were handcuffing the former paralegal and reading her her rights. Ashlyn realized there was no story to tell herself that didn't begin with the first of the 12 steps, she told me. She was powerless to overcome her addiction. She was about to lose her son, who was 6 at the time, because she had chosen heroin over him. She watched as officers extracted her belongings from the car, including her Narcotics Anonymous book, left over from 2 earlier rehab attempts, which had been there all along next to her purse. As the interstate traffic roared by, the agents waved the N.A. book around, laughing about it. Then they tossed it on the ground next to Ashlyn's other stuff. It was windy and unseasonably brisk that September day, and she remembered shivering by the side of the road in her flower print skirt, wedge sandals, and shirt, purple to match her purse. The man in charge of prosecuting Ashlyn Kessler keeps a portrait of the American president, James Garfield, above his desk. Before he was named Brigadier General in command of 2,500 U.S. Army reservists nationwide, Andrew Bassford was tasked with the job of laying a wreath on the grave of each one of the 8 Ohio-born presidents on the anniversary of his birth, then delivering a speech. Bassford viewed it as tedious but important work, the challenge being to say something inspiring while not repeating what he'd expounded upon the year before. Compared with the other Ohio presidents, Garfield is, in Bassford's view, an overlooked gem. He was a beast of a worker, his rags-to-riches story so inspiring that Horatio Alger penned his campaign biography. Among Bassford's favorite Garfield quotes, "Most human organizations that fall short of their goals do so not because of stupidity or faulty doctrines, but because of internal decay and rigidification. They grow stiff in the joints. They get in a rut. They go to seed." Bassford is also the assistant U.S. attorney in charge of prosecuting many of Western Virginia's heroin distribution and overdose death cases. That's his primary job, the brigadier general position being a part-time gig that takes him out of town on weekends twice a month. He takes being a prosecutor seriously, this important but sometimes tedious business of sending people like Ashlyn Kessler and Spencer Mumpower to prison, though he's the first to admit the system is inept and flawed. From his high and tight haircut to his dress cowboy boots, Bassford exudes law and order, communicating in staccato sentences and wry one-liners, like a character from the television series Dragnet. On the timing of illicit drug sales, for instance, "Heroin is morning, crack is night." On the federal judge who halved the prison time specified by Ashlyn's plea agreement, saying he was impressed by her perseverance after her arrest in a jail-based treatment program, "I think Judge Urbanski is trying to save those that he thinks can be saved." In 2017, Urbanski knocked Ashlyn's sentence down even more. On what Bassford thinks of law enforcement's efforts to quell the opioid epidemic? Not much. "The system is too rigidified," as Garfield would say, "not nimble enough to combat heroin's exponential growth, The drug's too addictive, the money too good. Bassford told me, you whack one dealer and the others just pop right up, like whack-a-mole. Bassford prosecuted Ashlyn and her dealer in 2015, but only after putting away her first heroin dealer from Southeast Roanoke, the white working-class neighborhood where heroin initially took hold in the city. 30-year-old Orlando Cotto had enlisted his girlfriend, his twin brother, an uncle, and a next-door neighbor to help him transport 60 grams of heroin every 2 weeks for distribution and use. They took turns meeting their supplier in the parking lot of a Burlington coat factory in Claymont, Delaware, clearing nearly $60,000 a month. After Ashlyn went to jail, Bassford said of subsequent dealers, I whacked four more, all intertwined with Ashlyn's and Cotto's networks. But the demand for heroin persisted, predicated on the evangelical model of users recruiting new users, and Bassford's whacks could not keep pace. We'll score a huge drug bust that we've been working on for maybe a year, and all that does is create a vacuum in the market that lasts maybe 5 to 7 days, said Isaac Van Patten, a Radford University criminologist and data analyst for Roanoke City Police. And because the amounts of money involved are so vast, we're not going to stamp it out. We don't enjoy the cooperation of the supplier nations, Van Patten explained, referring to drug cartel production in western Mexico, South America, and Afghanistan, with profits estimated at more than $300 billion a year. Their attitude is, Van Patten told me, tell your people who are wanting to consume our product, we're going to supply it. While Roanoke's quietest heroin users were privileged and upper middle class, Van Patten called them the cafe crowd, it didn't take long before suburban users like Ashlyn were casting their lot with former OxyContin addicts from the working class Southeast who were already tapped into illicit networks, he said. He told me, in the suburbs, heroin started out as a trendy drug that people believed they could control. But the rich kids spiraled right down with everybody else, and then suddenly you couldn't tell between the two. The rich kids were crashing alongside the poor kids on friends' couches, the lucky ones anyway, all of them cowering before the morphine molecule and beholden to its spell. 15 years earlier, Art Van Zee had predicted that OxyContin would eventually be recalled, but not until rich kids in the suburbs were dying from it. Now they were, and that pained him equally. He told me. I was absolutely dead wrong, he said. I thought of Tess Henry, the young mom I met in late 2015. The daughter of a local surgeon and a hospital nurse, they divorced when she was 10. Tess had grown up in multiple homes, one in the nicest section of Roanoke with mountain biking trails and the Blue Ridge Parkway abutting her backyard, the other on secluded Bald Head Island, North Carolina, accessible only via ferry. Tess was a high school track and basketball standout, an honor roll kid who would go on to study French at Virginia Tech and the University of North Carolina, Asheville, though she didn't complete a degree. Among the things she loved to do before she fell into a raging $200-a-day heroin habit were writing poetry, painting, reading, and singing to her dog, a black rescue mutt named Coda. The two were particularly happy when Tess belted out the words to Train's Hey Soul Sister in the car. Her favorite author in the world was David Sedaris. She'd run into him once in a local coffee shop after a reading, she told me, and he was so, so unbelievably nice. Of Patricia Merriman's four kids, Tess was the quietest, the one who voluntarily walked the dogs with her on the beach. Patricia emailed me a beach picture of the family Labrador Charlie and a 10-year-old Tess, all freckles and a toothy smile, with both arms wrapped around the dog. They liked to head out early at low tide to look for beach treasures. Patricia said she was the queen sand dollar finder. But Tess struggled with anxiety from a young age, her relatives told me, recalling a panic attack she had as a young teenager on the way home to Roanoke from the beach. She thought she was dying, Patricia remembered. She was throwing up and calling me from the backseat of the car. At her private Catholic primary school, where students wore blue and khaki uniforms, Tess was stressed that her shoes weren't right. Tess was 26 when we met, a waitress turned heroin addict. With a ruddy complexion and auburn hair, she wore leggings with long sweaters and liked to apply makeup cat-eye style at the edges of her eyes, which were luminous and shifted color from brown to green, depending on the light. She had consorted with most of the Hidden Valley crowd mentioned in this book, working not as a runner or mule, but as a lower-level middleman, as she called herself. She did worse than that, too. Perhaps she was genetically predisposed to addiction, her mom theorized. There were alcoholic relatives on both sides of the family. Tessa's older sister had been in recovery for 5+ years and was a devoted member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Perhaps during Tessa's college experimentation phase, it was the 25 Lortab pills a friend gave her, left over from a wisdom tooth extraction, that set her up for the ultimate fall. Tess knew only that her daily compulsion for opioids began in 2012, the same way 4 out of 5 heroin addicts come to the drugs, through prescribed opioids. For Tess, a routine visit to an urgent care center for bronchitis ended with 2 30-day opioid prescriptions, one for cough syrup with codeine and the other for hydrocodone for sore throat pain. When I ran out, I started looking for them on my own, through dealers, first through the drug-dealing boyfriend of a fellow waitress at the restaurant where they worked, Tess said. Asked how she had known what to do, she told me she Googled it. Because I was sick, jittery, diarrhea, all of it. I looked up my symptoms and what I'd been taking, and I realized, holy crap, I'm probably addicted. She could get anything she wanted from her dealer. In the beginning, she snorted 5 pills a day, usually Dilaudid, Roxycodone, Lortab, or Opana. Then several months into the routine, almost overnight, the pill supply dried up. Tess blamed it on the DEA's reclassification of hydrocodone-based drugs into a more restrictive category. She told me, that made it harder for my dealer to get pills. In October 2014, hydrocodone-based painkillers such as Vicodin and Lortab were changed from Schedule 3 drugs to Schedule 2, the same category as OxyContin. Regulations now limited doctors to prescription intervals of 30 days or less, with no refills permitted, and patients who needed more had to visit their doctors for a new prescription, as opposed to having it automatically called in to a pharmacy. Before the rule took effect, patients could have their pills refilled automatically as many as 5 times, covering up to 6 months. One reason narcotic prescriptions quadrupled from 1999 to 2010, and so did deaths. The so-called upscheduling had been controversial, with public opinion weighing in pro at 52% and con at 41%. Chronic pain patients complained loudly about the added cost and inconvenience. Just because the DEA cannot figure out how to control the illegal use of these drugs should not be a reason to penalize millions of responsible individuals in serious pain, one critic wrote in a published letter to pharmacist Joe Graydon, the People's Pharmacy columnist. On a website set up by the DEA for public feedback, several patients warned that rescheduling the drugs would limit their availability and drive people to street drugs, particularly heroin. Tess's dealer adapted swiftly to the switch. He said, "Here, try this. It's cheaper and a lot easier to get," she told me. Tess took her first snort of the light brown powder, same as she'd done with the crushed up pills. He was a serious dealer, she said, an African American who sold the stuff but was strict about never using himself. She said, "Not to sound racist or anything, but typically black opioid dealers do not use heroin. Good dealers don't use what they sell because they know they would just use it all." With the legalization of marijuana in a growing number of states, drug cartels were champing at the bit to meet the demand for heroin, a market they needed to grow. They were looking at a 30 to 40% reduction in profits because of legalization, explained Joe Crowder, a Virginia State Police special agent and part of the federally funded high-intensity drug trafficking area program that designated Roanoke a heroin hotspot in 2014. Crowder said, "Between the pill epidemic and the less liberal prescribing of pain meds, cartel leaders said, guess what's purer, cheaper, and we can make it all day long." Some dealers encouraged underlings to hot pack their product, giving super high potencies to new users to hook them quicker. Once the user is hooked, the product gets titrated back, forcing the person to buy more. Tess said she didn't consider herself a true addict until 6 months after she started snorting heroin, when she began injecting it. After 3 shots, though, she knew she'd never return to snorting. She showed me the scars inside her right elbow. Right-handed, she learned to use her left hand to mainline the drugs into her right arm because that vein was usually a sure hit. For a while, she was able to keep waitressing at a trendy, upmarket bistro featured in the likes of Southern Living and Garden and Gun. She wore long sleeves to hide her track marks and was still able, if she concentrated hard, to remember orders without writing them down. Around this time, a family friend told her mother, "Your daughter's an opiate addict." And Patricia Merriman had a reaction not unlike that of many other parents faced with the same accusation. She fumed, incredulous. After all, Tess never missed a day of work. She did everything she was supposed to, Patricia said. We were sitting in her comfortable sunroom, surrounded by woods. Patricia was way past denying it now. She'd spent the last 6 months navigating treatment hurdles and worse. Tess said, "I worked just to use, and I used just so I could work. There was no in-between." But that phase was brief, and neither Tess nor her mom had any idea what was coming next, or that the molecule had another, even higher card to play. No matter how low Tess got, it seemed there was always a deeper and fresher hell awaiting her. The addiction would out Tess eventually, as it always does, even though she was earning $800 a week at the restaurant. Even though she'd started middlemanning, recruiting and selling to new users in exchange for her cut of the drugs, she needed more money because she required ever larger quantities of heroin to keep from feeling shaky and dope sick. She was arrested twice early on, once when officers picked her up for being drunk in public downtown and found an unprescribed OxyContin in her pocket, and again when police caught her stealing gift cards from a store. The first charge was pleaded down from a felony to a misdemeanor, and Tess was sentenced to a year's probation and a weekend in jail. The second was treated purely as a theft. "I begged her public defender, 'This is not what it looks like. Send her to drug court,'" remembered her father, Alan Henry, from whom Tess was sometimes estranged. On May 15, 2015, an employee manning the security cameras at a Roanoke Lowe's alerted police to Tess. The camera caught her palming a copper plumbing implement and stuffing it into her purse. She'd done it before, stolen an item from one Lowe's, then returned it to another Lowe's, which would issue her a gift card for the value since she lacked a receipt. But this time they caught her before she left the store. "At the time of her arrest," she said, "I was already in withdrawal." At the Roanoke City Jail that night, with every pore on her body aching and every muscle spasming, a female jailer greeted her with a tiny cup. "Here, take this," the jailer instructed. The woman handed Tess the medicine, which had been ordered as a result of a routine urine screen. Inside the cup was a low dose of Tylenol with the opioid codeine. It was designed to keep the fetus growing inside Tess from going into sudden, potentially fatal opioid withdrawal. 25 and 5'7", Tess was down to 120 pounds. She hadn't had a regular period in 2 years. She had no idea she was at the end of her second trimester of pregnancy. At least in jail, for the immediate future, she and the baby were safe. 6 weeks later, the region's new HIDA task force issued a warning about a spike in opioid overdose incidents. Between May 1st and June 23rd, 2015, the local drug task force would investigate 11 overdose calls, 4 of them fatal. The culprit was fentanyl, once a popularly diverted opioid prescribed in patch form for advanced cancer patients that was now being illicitly imported from China and mixed with heroin or manufactured into pills. Some arrived from China via Mexico and, to a lesser extent, Canada. A synthetic opioid considered 25 to 50 times stronger than heroin, mail-order fentanyl had been arriving direct to residences across the United States, and so were the pill presses that local dealers used to turn the powder into pills. One quarter-ton press arrived in Southern California inside a package labeled Hole Puncher. Cartel lieutenants were setting up clandestine fentanyl labs across America, mixing the powder with heroin to increase the high, in products stamped with names like China Girl, Goodfella, Jackpot, and Cash. Some of the companies shipping this stuff from China will send you a free replacement package if it gets interdicted on the way to your home. News that people were dying from fentanyl-laced heroin didn't intimidate heroin addicts, according to several I interviewed. On the contrary, the lure of an even stronger high drew them to it more. Later that year, and again in 2017, China began banning, at the request of the DEA, the manufacture of several fentanyl analogs, which had previously been unregulated. But each time a derivative was banned, a DEA spokesman conceded, new spinoffs emerged from underground Chinese labs, some more potent than the originals. Law enforcement interdiction of the packages is tricky because it's hard to tell whether the shippers are illicit labs labeling the envelopes research chemicals, complete with phony return addresses, or legitimate companies providing the powder for pharmaceutical research. Back in 2015, Roanoke Police Chief Chris Perkins, 46, knew immediately fentanyl was going to be a game changer. It meant more teenagers would be drawn to the ever-potent blends, able to get high simply by snorting the drug and avoiding the stigma new users have about injecting, and later the telltale track marks. It meant some would buy counterfeit pills that were sold to them as Xanax or oxycodone, but were actually fentanyl. In his earliest days of working undercover drugs, Perkins had gone by the name Woody Call and wore the classic Serpico look, with a goatee and longish dark hair. It was the mid-1990s when heroin dealers used to step on or cut their product with baby powder. He remembers finding a pair of Radford University co-eds at one bust, naked on a couch in a Roanoke drug house, enveloped in a heroin fog. They'd exchanged sex for the drug, injecting it between their toes so their friends and professors wouldn't know. Stunned, Perkins remembers calling their parents in the Washington suburbs and saying, I can't tell you this over the phone. You just need to come. But now the cut had switched from baby powder to fentanyl, from mild to often lethal. The market is so saturated, I can't say it enough. There is so much heroin out there, sold not only by former crack dealers eager to diversify their product, but also by subordinates or sub-dealers, Perkins said. So much that Roanoke police seized 560 grams of the stuff in 2015 alone, the equivalent of 18,666 doses or shots. It was whack-a-mole on steroids. When police took one source out, there would be a short lag until the next source presented itself. Meantime, the overdoses kept stacking up, and that was before the worst spike in fentanyl hit. Perkins had long championed community policing in Roanoke, wherein officers engaged with teenagers in high-crime areas, often patrolling on bicycle, while always refining where they need to be using real-time data. Violent crime in the city, much of it previously crack-related, had dropped 64.5% and property crime 39.9% since 2006. A 2011 program Perkins pioneered, called the Drug Market Initiative, offered nonviolent offenders the opportunity to bypass jail and receive job training if they agreed to leave the drug trade. But the cell phone had put an end to open-air drug markets, enabling the coordination of drug buys in gas station and shopping mall parking lots. Hotels situated along the perimeter of Roanoke on I-81 and near Interstate 581, which cuts through the city center, were also prime drug deal spots because the higher-level distributors could sell there and quickly get back on the road. Experienced dealers were hiring addicted middlemen like Tess to conduct street-level business for them, lowering the dealer's risk. And shoplifting fueled by users like Tess had nearly doubled in the past 5 years. Violent crime was edging upward, too. A 34-year-old woman was murdered at a rent-by-the-week airport motel, known to be a hangout for the heroin addicted. A woman Jamie Waldrop had been coaxing toward treatment for months was found dead of overdose at a Howard Johnson's next to I-81. She's next on the list to be admitted, a rehab intake counselor texted Jamie the next day, but it was too late. She died in a motel last night, Jamie wrote back. It was time to get nimble again. On the eve of his retirement, Chief Perkins vowed to do something about Roanoke's surging heroin problem. A data geek as well as an incessant worrier, nights and weekends Perkins had crime reports emailed to his phone every hour, one of the reasons he retired early after 24 years on the force. He was eyeing a program he hoped to implement if he could just get buy-in from the disparate healthcare and criminal justice agencies. "This is what I'm going out on," he told me, almost manically, in late 2015. He hoped to follow the path of Gloucester, Massachusetts, Police Chief Joseph Campanello, who'd recently told the growing number of heroin users in his town, "Turn in your drugs, and I'll hook you up with treatment instead of handcuffs." By early 2017, the Gloucester model, called Police Assisted Addiction and Recovery Initiative, or PARI, had been adopted by 200 police agencies in 28 states. The HOPE initiative, as the PARI program in Roanoke would be called, was the impatient police chief's swan song. He said, "We want the carrot to be, we'll treat it like a disease, and if you stay clean, we'll go away." The idea was to create a public-private partnership where angels, or trained volunteers, help funnel addicts into treatment, mentoring them during the cumbersome and usually relapse-ridden march toward sobriety, kind of like an on-call NA sponsor, only with the skills of a social worker able to take advantage of the city's housing, mental health, and job resources. The program would be located at the Bradley Free Clinic, a long-running program for the working poor staffed by physician volunteers and located in Old Southwest, a burgeoning heroin hotspot. The clinic's executive director, Janine Underwood, wasn't a doctor. In the fall of 2015, she attended the first HOPE Initiative meeting, not because she ran a nonprofit medical clinic, but because her 28-year-old son, Bobby Bayless, was among the four who died of fentanyl-laced heroin that June, while Tess was in jail. Janine had spent the previous 7 years floundering as she watched Bobby seesaw between rehab and jail. He'd gotten clean, finally, she thought, during a 3-year prison sentence during which he'd participated in drug treatment and become a certified journeyman in heating and air conditioning. On probation back in Roanoke, Bobby was excelling at his new job, living in her basement and doing well after his release. "You could see the sparkle again in his eyes for the first time in years," she said. 3 months after leaving prison, a visit with some old Hidden Valley friends led to a single dose of fentanyl-laced heroin. Janine discovered Bobby's body, cold and blue, laid out on the basement floor, the evidence cleaned up, and his user-dealer friends long gone from the scene. Still raw in her grief, Bobby had been dead only 6 months. Janine could draw a detailed mental map of the flaws in the treatment landscape, from healthcare privacy hurdles and other treatment barriers, to the lack of guidance about what to do the moment you realize your 21-year-old is injecting heroin. Janine had found a box of hypodermic needles hidden in a box in the back of Bobby's closet. He'd wrapped them up in his baby blanket, sandwiched between soccer trophies and Boy Scout patches. What Janine did was sob. "It was the worst moment in my life. I didn't understand yet the connection between pills and heroin. I kept thinking, he's going to get better. It's just pills. I'm in healthcare, and there were just so many things I didn't know," she said. "It's almost impossible the way the systems are set up for a parent to get good treatment for their child." Janine was the first HOPE Initiative angel to tell the chief, "I'm in." The second was Jamie Waldrop, Christopher's mom, the one who'd personally accompanied her addicted son to the Montana rehab. By now, so many in the Hidden Valley circle of heroin users had become intertwined. Jamie's boys had known Bobby, Janine's son, who'd been in the same court-ordered halfway house as Spencer Mumpower, and Jamie's older son had at one point dated Tess. Jamie said, "It was like we had a dementor from Harry Potter who was swirling around the households of Hidden Valley going, 'I want you and you and you and you.'" The third volunteer was Terrence Engels, a former pro baseball player who progressed from taking injury-prescribed OxyContin to scamming pain management doctors on Manhattan's Upper East Side to overdosing on a Staten Island ferry in 2011. He'd just landed in Roanoke as a treatment consultant for American Addiction Centers with 3 years of sobriety. He spent most of his time in Roanoke trying to persuade addicted 20-somethings to go to treatment, whether it was to one of his company's dozen centers around the United States for those with insurance, or to the scant few regional or charity options, most of them faith-based and abstinence-only. "I get about 20 calls a week from people in crisis," he said. In Chief Perkins's ideal world, Carilion Clinic, the region's largest employer with nonprofit hospitals and a new research center already known for its work on addiction research, would provide much-needed inpatient treatment. No comparable treatment was available locally, only short-term detox programs, and one privately owned facility that accepted only insurance and cash. A 28-day stay ran about $20,000, and it didn't allow patients to take maintenance medications. Unlike Campanello's Massachusetts, Virginia could not rely on anything close to RomneyCare, the 2006 initiative signed into law by then-Bay State Governor Mitt Romney, guaranteeing insurance coverage to 99% of the state. Virginia's legislature had repeatedly turned down attempts to pass Medicaid expansion in the wake of the Affordable Care Act, sacrificing $6.6 million a day in federal funds and insurance coverage for 400,000 low-income Virginians, a frequent source of frustration for opioid-affected families and healthcare advocates. In states where Medicaid expansions were passed, the safety net program had become the most important epidemic-fighting tool, paying for treatment, counseling, and addiction medications, and filling other long-standing gaps in care. It gave coverage to an additional 1.3 million addicted users who were not poor enough for Medicaid, but too poor for private insurance. But in Virginia in June 2014, 1 year before the first fentanyl spike, state Republicans shut down the Democratic governor's proposal to expand it in a political plot that seemed lifted from House of Cards. Democratic Coalfield Senator Philip P. Puckett abruptly resigned to give the Republicans an expansion-quashing majority. Alleged motivations for his action included making his lawyer daughter eligible for a judgeship, the Senate's policy forbids judicial appointments of relatives, and also allowing him to nab a job with the commission that oversees economic development investments from Virginia's slice of the tobacco settlement. The last Democratic legislator west of Roanoke, whose Russell County region in Appalachia remains among the state's hardest hit by the epidemic, Puckett eventually removed himself from consideration for the tobacco post, citing family matters, while a six-month federal investigation into corruption claims went nowhere. Perkins hated political maneuvering. In his ideal world, the economics of securing help work like this. Since addicts would be diverted from jail, the cost savings from their empty jail beds could be put toward treatment. He said, "The problem is, it's easier to give money to the correction system to the tune of $1 billion in the state of Virginia than it is to take a couple of million dollars and provide inpatient treatment for our problem," he railed, blaming politics and the tendency among jailers and sheriff's departments to cling to bloated incarceration budgets championed during the war on drugs, even though 200 of the city jail's 800 beds were typically empty. But Frederick Douglass had it right when he said, "Power concedes nothing without a demand." Perkins pointed out that most addicted users returned to the streets from jail with more drug contacts than they had when they arrived. "I said it all 1,000 times, he said, "but I couldn't get anybody to listen because the sheriffs are elected officials with powerful lobbyists, and a poor old appointed police chief doesn't stand a chance." At the first Hope Initiative meeting, stakeholders were so focused on hurdles to treatment that Jamie worried the project would die before it ever got underway. Privately, she reached out to Police Chief Campanello in Massachusetts and asked him to do a conference call with the working group. She even suggested exactly what he should say, that if they waited till they solved all the obstacles, the program would never begin. Meanwhile, people were dying every day. By the end of 2015, 51,000 more Americans were dead of drug overdose, 1,000 more than died from AIDS in 1995, the peak year. And the epidemic displayed no signs of trending down. In fact, HIV, spurred by the sharing of dirty heroin needles, was on the rise again, with 65 new cases reported that year in rural Southwest Virginia alone. It was exactly what Art Van Zee predicted in one of his first letters to Purdue. "My fear is that these are sentinel areas, just as San Francisco and New York were in the early years of HIV," he had written of Lee County back in November 2000. Van Zee had no idea then that the OxyContin epidemic would become a heroin epidemic, which itself would lead to more deaths from HIV and hepatitis C. From a distance of almost two decades, it was easier now to see that we had invited into our country our own demise. Chapter 10. Liminality. I watched the HOPE initiative take hold in early 2016, at the same time I began following Tess Henry and her cheerful five-month-old son. I hoped that one day their stories would converge. But as loved ones and advocates eager to help heroin users navigate treatment have shown me, threading a needle blindfolded over a hotbed of coals might have made for a less complicated odyssey. Tess was nearly 7 months pregnant when she left jail in June 2015. For months, she lived with her mom and tried to make a go of it with her boyfriend, the baby's father. Disastrous, Patricia and Tess both agreed, before they found a private treatment center 2 hours away that would take Tess during her final month of pregnancy. Private insurance covered most of the $20,000 bill, while her dad paid the $6,500 deductible, using the remainder of Tess's college savings fund. The Life Center of Galax was one of the few Virginia facilities that accepted patients on medication-assisted treatment, methadone or buprenorphine. Tess was now taking Subutex, a form of buprenorphine then recommended for some pregnant mothers. Suboxone is typically the preferred MAT for opioid users because it also contains naloxone, an opiate blocker. Subutex, which is buprenorphine with no added blocker, was then considered safer for the baby, but more likely to be abused by the mom. After spending the first half of her pregnancy in the throes of heroin addiction and the second half on Subutex, Tess was nervous about the possibility of delivering a child with neonatal abstinence syndrome, a painful state of withdrawal that sometimes requires lengthy hospital stays. The syndrome is common even among so-called Subutex babies, about half of whom require neonatal intensive care and methadone treatment to facilitate their withdrawal from the medication. An NAS baby is a portrait of dope sickness in miniature. Their limbs are typically clenched as if in agony, their cries high-pitched and inconsolable. They have a hard time latching on to either breast or bottle, and many suffer from diarrhea and vomiting. When neonatologist Dr. Lisa Andrew-Scavage showed me the hospital's NAS services, nurses who had just spent the better part of an 8-hour shift coaxing an opioid-dependent baby girl born 4 weeks early to sleep, greeted us, only half-joking with, "If you two wake that baby up, we will kill you." While Tess's son was born 2 weeks early, he entered the world astonishingly healthy, showing zero signs of distress. He was not among the 55 babies born with NAS at Roanoke's Public Hospital that year, a rate well above the state's average. He was not among the children seen at the region's NAS clinic, where dependent babies released from the NICU come back for weekly check-ins while being very slowly weaned from methadone under their mother's or another family member's watch. Despite such attention, around 27% of the clinic babies end up in foster care. In fact, Tess's son was a calm baby, happy to sit on your lap, looking at a board book, or gumming a teething ring, or playing peekaboo. He had his mother's intense eyes, and his grin was captivating, bell-shaped and wide. Back then, Tess was fiercely protective, to the point of not letting strangers hold him, even for his first picture with Santa. She held him on her own lap instead, saying she was worried Santa might drop the baby or give him germs, a common reaction among drug-addicted new mothers, an NAS nurse told me. These moms are so over the top after they deliver because they're trying to show everybody how much they care, Kim Ramsey, the hospital's neonatology nurse specialist, explained. Many have been stigmatized by their friends and families, even by members of the hospital staff. "Our staff used to be really ugly to them," Ramsey admitted. "They'd say, 'This is ridiculous. These moms need to quit having babies and quit doing drugs,' myself included. We had no understanding that these women's brains have been altered, and what they need now more than anything for the sake of the baby is our support." Asked what her goal was in early 2016, Tess told me, "To be a good mom to my son. For right now, it's just to get some good sober time and eventually go back to school and live a normal life. Luckily, I have a nice family and I'm not dead or serving prison time. I'd been given second and third chances, so... The buprenorphine made her feel normal, as Tess thought of it, with insurance covering 80% of the medication's cost. Visits to her addiction doctor were cash only, though, requiring $700 up front and $90 to $100 per follow-up visit, as many as 4 a month, in order to be monitored and receive the buprenorphine, which prevents dope sickness and reduces cravings, theoretically without getting you high. It's a real racket, Tess's mom, Patricia, said of cash-only MAT practices, and there are waiting lists just to get into most of these places. At the time, federal Health and Human Services rules prevented MAT-certified doctors from treating more than 100 patients at a time, a cap adjusted to 275 later that year in response to the opioid crisis. Access to MAT in Virginia would broaden greatly in 2017, thanks largely to the efforts of Dr. Hughes Melton, a Lebanon addiction specialist tapped to help lead the state's Department of Health opioid response. Every week, piloting his own airplane, he would make the round trip between a Suboxone clinic called Higher Power in Lebanon, Virginia, and his office in Richmond. Melton also worked with state Medicaid officials to broaden reimbursements, as well as to include payment for mandatory counseling and care coordination, partly as an incentive for cash-only clinics to begin accepting insurance, including Medicaid. Some eventually did, but the vast human need for treatment was slow to be recognized and even slower to trickle down to most communities. As a workaround to the Republicans' refusal to expand Medicaid in Virginia, the governor's access plan, initiated in January 2015, would provide additional addiction treatment and services to 14,000 Virginians, but only to a fraction of those in need, and not until 2017, leaving most families to continue navigating wide treatment gaps on their own. Patricia told me, when calling facilities, there is rarely a sense of urgency for capturing the addict. An application process has to be completed. How many addicts on the street have insurance, Medicaid, or ability to fax lengthy applications or access to large amounts of cash? For now, Tess and her mom had to pay cash up front at every visit. Among public health officials, buprenorphine is considered the gold standard for opioid use disorder because it reduces the risk of overdose death by half compared with behavioral therapy alone. It also helps addicts get their lives together before they very slowly taper off, if they do. One researcher recommended that MAT users stay on maintenance drugs at least twice as long as the length of their addiction, while others believe it's too risky for long-term addicts to ever come off the drugs. But black market dealing of buprenorphine, especially Subutex, is rampant, and the drug can get you high if you inject or snort it, or take it in combination with benzodiazepines, a sometimes fatal blend. Though I'd visited several Suboxone clinics considered to be best practice beacons in addiction medicine, including Hughes Melton's in Lebanon and Art Van Zee's in St. Charles, a plethora of shoddy prescribers in rural Virginia and elsewhere in Appalachia had given the good clinics a bad name. Operating at clinics often located in strip malls and bearing generic-sounding names, some practitioners defy treatment protocols by not drug testing their patients or mandating counseling, and by co-prescribing Xanax, Klonopin, and other benzodiazepines, the so-called Cadillac High. Their treatment is a video playing in the lobby as 100 patients walk through to get their meds. It's insane, said Missy Carter, the Russell County Drug Court coordinator, who has dealt with widespread Suboxone abuse among her probationers as well as in her own family. Overprescribing among doctors specializing in addiction treatment was rampant, according to several rural MAT patients I talked to, who unpacked how Suboxone doctors prescribed them twice as much of the drug as they needed, fully knowing they would sell some on the black market so they could afford to return for the next visit. Others traded the prescribed Suboxone for illicit heroin or pills. Almost every Virginia law enforcement official I interviewed for this book despise Suboxone, and most Virginia drug court judges refuse to allow its use among participants. Nationally, roughly half of drug courts permit use of MAT, though the scales seem to bend toward acceptance as the crisis deepened. Critics compared the British makers of Suboxone with Purdue Pharma because of their zest for market saturation, and noted that clinic operators have a financial incentive not to wean someone off the drug. "We have people shooting up Suboxone and abusing it every which way," Mark Mitchell, the Lebanon police chief, told me. "For a town of just 3,400 to have 3 Suboxone clinics? That's absurd." "People outside of Appalachia don't believe me," said Sarah Melton, a pharmacy professor and statewide patient advocate who helps her husband Hughes run High Power, their Suboxone clinic, which mandates strict urine screening protocols with on-site group and individual counseling. "Suboxone, with its blocking agent naloxone, is a wonderful medicine, but we were seeing actual deaths from Subutex here, where people are injecting very high doses of it. And it comes down to these physicians wanting to make so much money, just like they did with the opioid pills," she said. Subutex is a monoproduct version of buprenorphine. Lacking the added naloxone blocker, it is therefore more coveted among some of the addicted, who like the option of being able to take additional opioids, such as Percocet at night to get high, multiple users told me. In Johnson City, Tennessee, just over the Virginia border, where several of the nation's top buprenorphine prescribers have offices, one cash-only prescriber admitted as much in a public forum, saying, "We give them enough so they can sell it and stay in treatment," Melton recalled. Buprenorphine is the third most diverted opioid in the country, after oxycodone and hydrocodone. Hope Initiative angels like Jamie Waldrop and Janine Underwood were opposed to buprenorphine because, based on their son's experience, it was too easily diverted and abused. Patricia wasn't initially a fan either because of the expense and the lack of accountability on the part of Tessa's doctor, whose drug testing and counseling protocols seemed lax. She texted me after taking care of a 25-year-old IV Suboxone user at the hospital where she worked, who claimed that 90% of all Suboxone was abused, to which I gently replied to her, "I know Suboxone abuse is awful, but at least no fentanyl is in it, so it's somewhat safer than street heroin." Tess, too, had clearly figured out how to abuse the drug meant to keep her off heroin. Patricia found spoons and Subutex powder among her things, and Tess told me she doubled her dosage when stressed. Patricia fumed, too, because all but one of the treatment centers she'd called when Tess was pregnant refused to accept her until she'd been detoxed from all drugs, including buprenorphine. Even the hospital where she delivered the baby refused to give her a script for MAT. Instead, they arranged for Tess to be seen at a local methadone clinic after Patricia refused for a day to take Tess and the baby home, complaining that it was an unsafe discharge. They landed at the clinic moments before it closed with the newborn in tow. Patricia said, "I'm walking around the methadone clinic parking lot for 2 hours with a 4-day-old baby. And it was loaded with addicts. It was a place where Tessa's circle of addicts would become even bigger than it already was." On days when Patricia had to work, her octogenarian father, who walks with a cane, drove Tess to the clinic. "It's a broken system," said Ramsey, the nurse clinician. "Too few obstetricians chose to become wavered to prescribe Suboxone, and very few drug-tested their pregnant moms, afraid of offending upper-middle-class patients and hiding behind their American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists' recommendation that a verbal screening suffices." "We need to test all pregnant moms," Ramsey said in a heated NAS unit policy meeting I sat in on that pitted pediatric against obstetric staff. She said, "We're doing pregnant moms no favors by denying them the proper screening. It's why movie stars and musicians get the crappiest health care, because no one wants to tell Prince he has an opioid problem." Tess relapsed not long after giving birth, Patricia discovered when she came home from a walk in the woods to find a man lurking around her mailbox. He told Patricia he'd come to return $30 he owed Tess, but Patricia guessed, correctly, that he was a drug dealer. Tess went back to treatment in Galax for another month while the grandmothers kept the baby, then around 6 weeks old. By the time I met Tess, she had just returned home and was hoping to transfer to a sober living or halfway house, but the problem was many didn't allow MAT, and none of the available facilities would allow her to bring the baby. So she was back in her mom's house and on MAT. Though she didn't agree with Tessa's MAT doctor's protocols and cash payment restrictions, Patricia was grateful she took Tess on as a patient when all the other area prescribers had long waiting lists. Tessa's problems were growing worse by the minute, and the systems designed to address them were lagging further behind, mired in bureaucratic indifference. For several months in early 2016, I drove Tess and her baby to Narcotics Anonymous meetings, recording our interviews with Tess's permission on my phone as I drove, and walking the baby around the back of the meeting room when he cried.